The producers. Nobody should be surprised to find the most sordid practices behind these trials. We have seen in Chapter 1, pages 45 to 48 of the print edition, that no ethical limitations were respected, in the means sometimes employed to produce quote-unquote evidence. We should, therefore, take a closer look at who was in charge in Case 11. Recall that there was no substantial indictment process involving a grand jury, and that, as one may confirm by reading Dubois' book, it was the prosecution in each case that decided who was to be put on trial, and with what he was to be charged. The Wilhelmstrasse case was not really commensurate with the other cases tried before the NMT. All of the latter had special purpose characters, as Table 4 shows, page 40. The Ministries or Wilhelmstrasse case, however, was somewhat like a little IMT, that is, people from an assortment of German government ministries were put on trial, and the trial had a correspondingly wide scope. Thus, it was split into an economic ministries section and a political ministries section, each of which had different prosecution staffs. The important section from our point of view and, indeed, the most politically important case to come before the NMT, was the political ministries section of Case 11, whose chief prosecutor was Robert M. W. Kempner, who is quite a history. It is very useful to present a short summary here of the quote-unquote high points of his career. Kempner, a Jew, was born in Germany in 1899, studied law, and joined the Prussian Ministry of Interior during the 20s. In the years 1928 to 1933, he was a senior counsel for the Prussian State Police, under the Ministry of the Interior, and specialized in investigating the rising Nazi Party. He became an anti-Nazi crusader in his official capacity, and energetically attempted, without success, to have the party outlawed. When the Nazis took over the German government in 1933, he was dismissed from his government position, but although Jewish, he was able to continue his legal practice for a short while, as a counselor in international law on Jewish migration problems and also, apparently, as legal counsel for the German Taxi Drivers Organization. Whether or not he spent any time in a camp or in some other form of detention is not clear. In any case, he moved to Italy in 1935 to take an administrative and teaching, political science, position at a small school in Florence. The Mussolini government closed the school in 1938, so the school and Kempner moved to Nice, France. He did not remain with the school for very long, however, and emigrated to the United States in 1939. His mother already had a research job at the University of Pennsylvania, and this connection seems to have landed him his research associate position at that university. He immediately resumed his anti-Nazi crusading. He had somehow managed to smuggle out of Germany some of the Prussian police papers to which he had contributed, and these became the basis of a book, which he published privately in 1943. The book, in stencil form, attempted to show, on the basis of Kempner's past experiences in Germany, what should be done in Germany after the war in order to permanently suppress Nazism. It did not achieve wide circulation but, together with some other books and articles that he wrote, established him as a sort of expert on fighting Nazis. He had also smuggled out some phonograph recordings of Nazi meetings. These had been made by the Prussian police during the years of his service. He contributed them to the University of Pennsylvania. He also did a certain amount of anti-Nazi letter writing to the newspapers. As the war was drawing to a close, he wrote that the Nazi leaders should be tried in the U.S. before regular American courts. In the meantime, he had acquired U.S. citizenship. During the war, he worked for both the U.S. Department of Justice and the OSS. In the latter agency, he was charged with drawing up lists of German anti-Nazis who could be trusted with posts in the coming occupation government of Germany. He was one of a large group of German Jews in the OSS, which included, for example, Herbert Marcuse. At the end of the war, Kempner switched to the War Department and accompanied the U.S. Army back into Germany, quote, on the payroll of the Judge Advocate General, unquote. Prior to the opening of the IMT trial, he served in the fairly significant role of prosecution liaison with defense counsel, and later on was in charge of the division that prepared the U.S. trial briefs against individual defendants. During the trial, he was an apparently ordinary member of the prosecution staff, and specialized in the prosecution of the Nazi Minister of the Interior Frick. He does not appear to have been particularly prominent, although immediately after the trial, he contributed a magazine article to the New York Times on the great work the trial had done in educating the Germans. The killings of the German military and political leaders had not yet been carried out, so he simultaneously predicted, with great satisfaction, that the doomed Nazis would be buried in unmarked graves to, quote, avoid fanatical pilgrimages by still ardent Nazis, unquote. Actually, the ultimate procedure was even more hysterical, because the bodies of Göring and colleagues were photographed, in order to be gloated over shortly later in the press and in newsreels, disguised in U.S. Army uniforms, taken secretly to Dachau and cremated there, the ashes being sifted into a nearby stream. As he was taking over his responsibilities in Case 11 in 1947, Kempner was in the news in a related, but nevertheless highly important connection from the point of view of our subject. In 1943 and 1944, there had been held, in the land of the free press, some quote-unquote sedition trials of Americans whose views of the U.S. government's war policies were considered unwelcome. The U.S. prosecutor was O. John Rogg, an Ohioan who had, in his youth, been expected by family and friends to enter the ministry. He became a lawyer instead, and is said to have turned in a brilliant performance at the Harvard Law School. Attorney General Biddle chose him to prosecute the quote-unquote sedition case, replacing William P. Maloney, whose methods had provoked protests from several influential members of Congress. The proceedings, involving 30 defendants, were completely contrary to U.S. constitutional principles, and were fortuitously aborted when the trial judge passed away in November 1944, and a mistrial was declared. While the government was planning to resume the case, the Supreme Court had reversed another sedition conviction, and grave doubt arose within the Justice Department about the wisdom of continuing the spectacle. We hope the reader will abide this long digression on the quote-unquote sedition episode within the present digression on Kempner, for the point to be made is most important. Rogg lost interest in the sedition case as such, but he did not lose interest in the general subject of a fascist internal menace in the U.S. In the spring of 1946, he went to Germany on an 11-week quote-unquote information-gathering expedition, and accumulated some alleged facts that he summarized in a report, which he submitted to the Justice Department later in the year. Because there was no immediate reaction from the Justice Department to the material he had submitted, it appears that he got impatient and could not restrain himself. He therefore resorted to going around giving speeches, in which he divulged some of the quote-unquote information he had been able to gather by interrogating Germans. In a speech to B'nai B'rith in New York in October 1946, he reported in very general language that fascists are still at large, quote, in the world and in this country. Now the fascists can take a more subtle disguise, they can come forward and simply say I am anti-communist, unquote. A few days later, he was much more specific whom he was talking about. John L. Lewis, president of the United Mine Workers, and the late William R. Davis, an oil operator and promoter, had, he declared in a speech at Swarthmore College, conspired with Goering and Ribbentrop to defeat President Roosevelt in the elections of 1936, 1940 and 1944. According to the quote-unquote evidence that he had obtained in Germany, other prominent Americans who, in the view of the Nazis, quote, could be organized against United States participation in the war, unquote, included, he said, Senator Burton K. Wheeler, former Vice President John N. Garner, former President Herbert Hoover and Democratic bigwig James A. Farley. Rogg had also given some of his material to Drew Pearson, and it appeared in Pearson's column at about the same time. For such flagrant violation of the rules and standards of the Justice Department and of the legal profession and also, presumably, for stepping on some important political toes, Rogg was immediately dismissed from the Justice Department by Attorney General Clark. Rogg defended his actions, explaining that, after all, he had merely made, quote, a study of international fascism, for the people under investigation were part of an international movement to destroy democracy both here and abroad, unquote. Again he was specific, two of the people posing the fascist threat were Mr. Douglas McCollum Stewart and Mr. George T. Eggleston, at the time a member of the staff of the Reader's Digest. Rogg said that in Germany he had obtained information about them from former German diplomats, who had had official connections with the U.S. before Pearl Harbor. Pravda described Rogg's removal as a scandal. In the period before Pearl Harbor, Stewart and Eggleston had published the Scribner's Commentator, which was dedicated to keeping the U.S. out of World War II. During 1941, Stewart had received a large sum of money, $38,000, and could not explain where it came from. He told the sedition grand juries of 1943 to 1944 that he had found this money in his home. Since such a story sounds ludicrous even to an impartial observer, Stewart was assailed by the prosecutor and judge for giving such testimony. His refusal to change it led to his being held in contempt of court, and he was sentenced to serve 90 days in jail. He was paroled after 75 days. In the course of 1946, the Justice Department, including even Rogg, had become convinced that no sedition charge could succeed in court, so the case that had been opened in 1943 was finally closed. However, there was still the matter of Stewart's testimony, which seemed a good basis for a perjury charge. Thus, in March 1947, Stewart was put on trial for committing perjury and testifying before the wartime grand jury. The prosecution claimed that Stewart had received $15,000 of the $38,000 from the German government, and produced two witnesses to support its contention. Baron Herbert von Strempel, former first secretary of the German embassy in Washington, testified that he had given Stewart $15,000 in the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York in the fall of 1941. The money had been obtained, he said, from Dr. Hans Thompson, German chargé d'affaires. Thompson then testified in support of von Strempel's story. The testimony of Strempel and Thompson was, in fact, the direct consequence of Rogge's information-gathering expedition in Germany in 1946. Stewart's defense produced evidence that Stewart had received large sums of money from American sources in 1941. It claimed that some wealthy Americans wished to support the, by then, beleaguered cause of staying out of the war, but anonymously, so they slipped money to Stewart anonymously. Whether this claim was truthful or the truth was that Stewart had, indeed, lied before the wartime grand jury on account of feeling himself obliged not to divulge the identities of his American supporters, is scarcely relevant to our subject. More relevant was the defense cross-examination of the prosecution's German witnesses, because the defense was able to discredit the prosecution case by showing that the testimony had been coerced. Baron von Strempel said that he had been arrested in Hamburg by two British agents who, when asked for their warrant, quote, smiled, drew their guns from their shoulder holsters, and said that was their warrant, unquote. He then spent 4 weeks in an American interrogation center and then 7 months in a detention camp, where he was again subject to continual questioning. During this period, his health was quote-unquote never so bad. He was questioned by Robert M. W. Kempner, but did not want to talk about this. Judge Laws was obliged to direct von Strempel to reply to defense attorney McGee's questions about this feature of his experiences. He finally said that Kempner had told him that if he, quote, concealed any embassy dealings, unquote, he would be court-martialed and sentenced to death. He then told the whole story. Incessant intensive questioning by interrogators made him feel as if he had been hypnotized. O. John Rogge became one of von Strempel's interrogators in Germany. During Rogge's interrogation, he said, his necktie and shoelaces were removed, he was kept in solitary confinement, was questioned all day without food, and was, quote, at all times under duress, unquote. He admitted that he had signed a statement, but said that this was on account of fear of further solitary confinement. He gave this testimony, so destructive to the prosecution's case, despite the fact that the U.S. was paying him $70 per week, plus hotel expenses, in connection with his appearance as a witness against Stewart. There was also the possibility of U.S. retaliation via some sort of war crimes charge. Thompson was likewise cross-examined. He admitted that von Strempel had told him of the death threat, and said that he had been coached by Rogge in recalling details. The jury found Stewart innocent during the course of a lunch break. Thus had Kempner appeared in the newspapers even before Case 11 had gotten underway. In examining the sedition affair, we have, therefore, encountered the Wilhelmstrasse case, in the sense that Kempner enters the picture as interrogator and potential prosecutor of incarcerated former officials of the German Foreign Office. The connection with Case 11 is even more substantial because Stewart's attorney in the 1947 trial, Warren E. McGee, was shortly later to become co-counsel for Baron von Weizsäcker, the principal defendant in Case 11. We therefore have the unusual fact that the two sides involved in Case 11 had, almost simultaneously, clashed in a regular U.S. legal proceeding, and that the testimony that had been the result of the interrogation of the captive Germans had been successfully challenged by the defense as coerced. This is an extraordinary and important confirmation of the kind of activity, indicated by the evidence we have already reviewed, which must have transpired behind the scenes at the NMT, carrot and stick tactics of various sorts, including even third-degree methods in some cases, but not necessarily in all cases where the evidence could correctly be said to have been coerced. McGee's successes along these lines did not, moreover, cease with the Stewart trial. In another extraordinary choice of a person to use as a prosecution witness rather than put on trial, Kempner had used Friedrich Gauss, who had a reputation as Ribbentrop's evil spirit, as the chief prosecution witness against von Weizsäcker. McGee, evidently by virtue of being an American having access to documents denied the German lawyers, was able to prove in court that Kempner had threatened to hand Gauss over to the Russians, if Gauss did not cooperate with the prosecution, a frequent and effective threat that had certain variations. Hofliger, one of the defendants in Case 11, was a Swiss citizen, but according to his trial testimony, he was told by interrogator Sachs that if he stood on his Swiss nationality, he would be turned over to the Russians, and Sachs urged him, quote, to note that there were no diplomatic relations between Russia and Switzerland, unquote. Much more to the point is the fact that von Todten, under cross-examination by defense attorney Dr. Schmidt-Leichner, admitted that Kempner, in connection with an execution that had supposedly been carried out by German authorities in France, quote, had made me understand that there were two possibilities for me, either to confess or to be transmitted to the French authorities, before a French tribunal, where the death penalty would be sure for me. A delay of 24 hours was accorded me, during which I had to decide, unquote. A Swiss journalist wrote at the time that Kempner and colleagues were attempting to misrepresent Nazism as a, quote, concoction of the German upper classes, unquote, in order to destroy the pre-Nazi social structure of Germany. Rogge had a long and interesting career, but a thorough summary would carry us too far afield. In fairness to him, we should say that his behavior in connection with the sedition cases should not lead one to assume that he was insensitive in regard to civil liberties, because when the first post-war steps were being taken to set up an anti-communist internal security program, Rogge started yelling about witch hunts and, in the following years, became chairman of the New York State Henry Wallace for President Committee, a perfectly logical appointment, because Rogge embodied all that was unique in that movement's approach to dealing with the Soviet Union. Characterized by the left-wing magazine Nation in 1950 as, quote, the lone independent in various communist-operated congresses, committees, and delegations, unquote, he had traveled to Moscow in March to attend the World Congress of Partisans for Peace. He explained to the Soviets that the Cold War was equally the fault of both sides, and stood up in a formal meeting in the Kremlin and quoted Thomas Jefferson, actions that were not appreciated by his Soviet hosts. The Nation commented further that, quote, it is easy to put down O. John Rogge as a quixotic busybody, a fuzzy-minded liberal so out of touch with reality, that he believes the ills of the world to be merely the result of unfortunate misunderstanding. He has shown why the Russian rulers regard with suspicion even their own followers who have had contact with the West, unquote. Rogge also involved himself in the widely publicized Trenton Six murder case of 1948-1953 as a lawyer for the Civil Rights Congress. In December 1949, the judge barred him from the New Jersey trial for, quote, violating the lawyer's canons of ethics by denouncing the conduct of the trial in public, by showing studied discourtesy and contempt in the court and by deliberately distorting the facts. The judge also charged that the Civil Rights Congress collected more money from the public than was needed for the trial, unquote. 7 months later, a U.S. court held that Rogge's barring from the trial was wrong but did not order his restoration. This short discussion of Rogge suffices for our purposes. To return to Kempner. When the Bonn government had been newly constituted in 1949, he warned of incipient Nazism there. Such a view did not prevent him from serving, 2 years later, as Israel's representative to Bonn in negotiations relative to the restitution of Jews who had suffered injury at the hands of the Nazi government. However, the next month, he was attacking the reprieves and reductions of sentences of quote-unquote war criminals that had been granted by the U.S. Kempner next appeared in connection with the 1952 House investigation of the Cotton Forest Massacre, a well-known Russian atrocity whose handling by the IMT throws full light on the absurdity of that tribunal's claim to respect. On April 13, 1943, the Germans announced that, in the Cotton Forest near the city of Smolensk in Russia, midway between Minsk and Moscow, mass graves of Polish officers who had been captured by the Russians in 1939 had been uncovered. 4 days later, the Minister of Defense of the Polish government in exile, in London, announced that he was requesting the International Red Cross to make an inquiry. The Germans supported the proposed inquiry but the Russians opposed it, referring to the London Poles as Hitler's Polish collaborators, and on April 26 broke diplomatic relations with that government over the matter. On account of the Russian opposition, the Red Cross refused to get involved. However, the German government exhibited the Cotton mass graves to various parties of Poles, to a group of foreign newspaper correspondents, to a group of German journalists, to small parties of British and American POWs, to a technical team of the Polish Red Cross and, most importantly, to an international commission of experts in forensic medicine, specialists in rendering medical opinions in legal proceedings. The commission concluded with a report which demonstrated the certainty that these Polish officers had been murdered by the Russians prior to the outbreak of war between Russia and Germany in June 1941. When the graves had first been discovered, the German propaganda service, not knowing how many bodies were to be found there, but knowing the approximate number of Polish officers who could have been involved as victims, used the figure of 10,000 and 12,000 as the number of bodies discovered, and these were the figures which were given the widest publicity during the war. Consequently, at the IMT, the indictment charged the Germans with murdering 11,000 Polish officers at Cotton, although it had been established, later in 1943, that there were only 4,253 bodies to be found. This fact was published by the German government, but naturally, because it contradicted their earlier claims, the Germans did not give the correct figure great publicity. But since the remaining officers were never found, it can be assumed they all fell victim to the Soviet firing squads. What happened at the IMT with respect to this charge illustrates the foolishness of that tribunal's claim to anything approximating legal jurisdiction. The testimony of members of the Forensic Commission was naturally of interest, so the Russians produced Professor Marko Markov, a citizen and resident of Bulgaria, who had been one of the signers of the commission report. Bulgaria being, by then, under Soviet control, Markov had changed his mind and testified in support of the Russian position, meaning that the Germans had intimidated him into approving the commission report. Goering's counsel, on the other hand, applied to have profession by the chairman of the commission, called to testify. On this point, one can see the emptiness of the tribunal's effectiveness in getting at the truth, even if it had wished to. Naval was a Swiss citizen, resident in Geneva, and could not be forced to testify and, in fact, he declined to testify. The motivation is obvious. The counsel for Field Marshal Keitel also requested that Naval, who had also been an International Red Cross representative, answer some questions, relative to a different subject, to be put to him in writing, but it appears that this interrogation did not materialize. Thus, the IMT tribunal, by its very nature, was prejudiced against the appearance of the most reliable type of witness, the citizen of a country which had been neutral during the war and independent after the war. I am only saying that the IMT could not compel testimony from such people. We have seen that Burkhardt, the president of the Red Cross, voluntarily answered written questions put to him in Switzerland for Kaltenbrunner's defense. The defense ended up by calling three German soldiers to testify. Three witnesses were allowed to each side on this matter. The tribunal's final disposition of the cotton issue was a disgrace, even independent of the true facts concerning the atrocity. It was quietly dropped and does not appear in the judgment. The Germans were not found either guilty or not guilty of this Russian atrocity. The IMT ducked the whole matter. In 1952, the U.S. House of Representatives investigated the cotton massacre, and naturally made an inquiry into what had happened at the IMT in this respect. The select committee set up for this purpose accordingly held some hearings in Frankfurt, Germany, in April of that year. The committee heard, among others, representatives of both the defense and prosecution legal staffs of the IMT. To speak for the German side, the committee logically called Dr. Otto Stammer, who had been counsel for the principal defendant Goering, who had also been the defendant who had pressed this particular matter at the IMT. To speak for the American prosecution, the committee, surprisingly, chose Robert M.W. Kempner. Examination of the trial record reveals no reason why Kempner should have been selected for this role. That Kempner appears to have been living in Germany at this time, and that the committee naturally thought it convenient that he testify at the Frankfurt hearings, does not explain anything. During the course of all of its hearings, the only other member of the prosecution that the committee heard was Justice Jackson, but his appearance in November in Washington was somewhat ceremonial, and added nothing to the record. According to the record of the public hearing held in Frankfurt, Kempner explained that the cotton massacre was, according to the understandings among the prosecution staffs, quote, a clear-cut Russian affair, and was handled right from the beginning by the Russians. We had no right to interfere in any way, unquote. Nevertheless, after the witnesses had been heard, the general view, according to Kempner, was that Goering had scored a victory on this point. Thus, the failure to mention cotton in the judgment called into question the integrity of the Nuremberg trials, and a realization of this was implicit in the questions asked by the committee members. Kempner was asked about possible participation by the U.S. prosecution staff in the behind-the-scenes activity in regard to cotton, and denied that such had taken place. In response to questioning, he also denied that there had been any, quote, conspiracy or attempt to collude between anybody on the American side and anybody on the Russian side, unquote. The New York Times reported that the tone of the Frankfurt hearing was such that, quote, the principles governing the trial procedure in Nuremberg were being questioned. United States officials at the hearing privately expressed concern over the situation, unquote. The Chicago Tribune reported that, at a secret session the night before the public hearing in Frankfurt, Kempner had admitted that the U.S. prosecution staff at the IMT had possessed evidence showing that the Russians had committed the cotton murders. The Select Committee on the Cotton Forest Massacre concluded that the U.S. government had suppressed the truth about cotton, both during and immediately after the war. In particular, a report by Lieutenant Colonel John H. Van Vliet Jr., one of the American POWs who had witnessed the mass graves, quote, later disappeared from either Army or State Department files, unquote. It was also found that the Federal Communications Commission had intimidated radio stations in order to suppress criticism of the Russians. In the years immediately following 1952, there was little for Kempner to do in relation to Nazis, but with the Eichmann affair, he was back in action, and served as a quote-unquote consultant to the Israeli government in assembling evidence for the trial. From that point on, he was very active. He contributed an article to the Yad Vashem Studies on Methods of Examining Nazis in Trials, and he published a book in German, Rehashing Old Propaganda Myths. In 1971, he expressed approval of the conviction of Lieutenant Kelly, and in December 1972, he endorsed the quote-unquote evidence that Ladislas Ferrago had gathered, in connection with Ferrago's Martin Bormann is an Argentina fiasco of that month. Evidently yearning for the old days, Kempner declared that the, quote, United States and its allies should reopen the Bormann case within the framework of the International Military Tribunal, unquote. Bormann had been tried in absentia at the IMT and sentenced to death. He was never found, and it is now generally agreed that he died in Berlin. In regard to Kempner, three principal conclusions may be drawn from this short summary of the man's career, based entirely on material in the public record. First, he could accurately be characterized as a fanatical anti-Nazi, starting in the 20s, when the Nazis were certainly no more criminal than several other groups on the violent and chaotic German political scene. The communists and social democrats also had private armies. Anti-Nazism is obviously Kempner's consuming vocation. Second, he was an extremely important figure in the trials that the US held in Nuremberg. We have seen that he had critically important responsibilities in connection with the IMT, and was also treated, later on, as a particular authority on what had gone on there. At the end of the IMT trial, the press described him as, quote, Jackson's expert on German matters and chief of investigation and research for Jackson, unquote. At the NMT, he took over the prosecution of the most important case, the political section of the Wilhelmstrasse case, and he may well have been the most important individual on the Nuremberg staff, although further research would be required to clarify the real power relationships that existed on the Nuremberg staff, if such clarification is possible. James M. McCanney headed the division that prepared cases 1, 4, 7, 8, 9, and 12. Other significant persons at the NMT have been discussed by Taylor. The Encyclopedia Judaica describes Kempner as chief prosecutor at the NMT trials. The third conclusion that may be drawn is that there are excellent grounds, based on the public record, for believing that Kempner abused the power he had at the military tribunals, and produced quote-unquote evidence by improper methods involving threats and various forms of coercion. The Stewart case makes this conclusion inescapable. This is the man who held the power of life and death over Eberhard von Totten and Horst Wagner. Our digression on Kempner is concluded. We came to the point, in our analysis of Hungary, where irregularities in the production of evidence in Case 11 were clearly indicated. Thus, it was necessary to examine two subjects: who was in charge in Case 11? And what was the level of integrity maintained in the operations of the trials at Nuremberg? It was found that the truth in regard to the latter subject was established rather decisively in the course of examining the former. A study of Kempner's career reveals all that one needs to know in order to evaluate the reliability of the evidence generated at the Nuremberg trials. Clearly, any person who wished to maintain the authenticity of the Hungary-related documents that imply extermination must produce some tortured story whose structure we cannot begin to imagine. Another person involved in the documents is Fesenmeier, who was a defendant in the Wilhelmstrasse case, and who was questioned in connection with some of these documents. The general position taken in his testimony was a reasonable one, in view of his objective of gaining acquittal or a light sentence. He had to report everything that went on in Hungary, and thus, Jewish measures were in his reports. However, these measures did not have the importance in his mind at that time that they have in our minds at this time. He testified that he often got 20 assignments a day, and in the course of a month would receive mutually contradictory assignments. His reports, he said, were naturally prepared by assistants, hastily scanned by him, and then signed. Shown documents, which have him reporting that two transports, each of 2,000 Jews fit for work, were sent to Auschwitz in April 1944, and asked if this were correct, he remarked that he had no specific memory but that it was quote-unquote quite possible, but that he never knew what Auschwitz was. Shown NG 5567, which had him reporting that up to June 17, 326,009 Jews had been deported from Hungary, he also remarked, quite possible. In other words, he did not want to involve himself, in any way, in these matters by taking any strong position, either assenting or dissenting, with respect to the alleged facts. If he had said that he clearly recollected, in detail, mass deportations of Jews and the numbers alleged in the spring and summer of 1944, then such testimony would have implicated him in the alleged exterminations. On the other hand, if he had denied that such mass deportations had taken place, then he would, in effect, have been claiming close involvement in whatever had happened, and he would have also, by such testimony, flung down a challenge to the prosecution and court which they couldn't possibly have ignored. Thus the logic of his testimony. He said that he was concerned with moving the Jews out of Budapest because of the danger of revolt as the Russians approached. Pressed on this matter, he explained that, quote, in practice the question was, will the front hold or won't it? If Budapest revolts, the whole front will be rolled up. If I participated in such conversations, which I won't deny is possible, then I participated exclusively from a military point of view. What can I do to hold up the Eastern Front as long as possible? Only from that point of view, unquote. Fesenmeier was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment, but he was out by early 1952. This seems to be as good a place as any to point out a fact that seems to be effectively forgotten by many writers on this subject. There was a war going on during World War II. The Germans were thinking about ways of winning it, not about exterminating Jews. The claim of NG 2233 that the extermination program had rail priority over military production is absolutely ridiculous.